Hello and welcome to our Alaska Collaborative on Health and the Environment teleconference, Only One Chance, How Contaminants in Our Environment Impair Brain Development, with guest presenter Dr. Philippe Grandjean. My name is Diana DeFazio, and on behalf of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, I'll be facilitating today's call. TAE Alaska is a regional partnership group of the National Collaborative on Health and the Environment. TAE Alaska aims to advance knowledge and effective action to address growing concerns about the links between human health and environmental factors. You can find more information on the following websites, akaction.org and healthandenvironment.org. Everyone who signed up for the call should have received an email from me yesterday with a link to today's presentation slides. If you don't have that link in front of you, you can access the PDF on our homepage at akaction.org. Just click on the announcement for today's call, which will bring you to the call webpage. Towards the top of the page, there's a link that says presentation. The call will last 1 hour with some time at the end for questions. We hope to have 5 to 10 minutes at the end for your questions. Before introducing Dr. Grandjean, I want to say that we are truly honored that he accepted our invitation to speak with us today. His work and that of his colleagues is critical in building the scientific evidence that will convince our leaders that our current system is broken and that we simply cannot continue to allow industrial chemicals to be used without any significant testing for safety, when we know that early exposure to certain chemicals damages children's brains, and we suspect that many other chemicals are similarly harmful. Here at Alaska Community Action on Toxics, we're actively working to address the problem of neurodevelopmental toxicants through state legislation in a new Toxic-Free Children's Act, which we hope will be introduced soon. The proposed legislation addresses 10 toxic flame retardant chemicals. We're also working for much-needed reform of the Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA, our federal chemicals policy. And on the international level, ACAT is working for global elimination of chemicals that disproportionately affect peoples of the Arctic. These include pentachlorophenol, deca-BDE, which is a flame retardant, and short-chained chlorinated paraffins. If you'd like more information about our work or would like to get involved, we invite you to contact us and join in our efforts. And now it is my honor to welcome and introduce Dr. Philippe Grandjean. Dr. Grandjean is chair of the Environmental Medicine Research Unit at the University of Southern Denmark and adjunct professor of environmental health at the Harvard School of Public Health. He was born in Denmark and graduated as an MD from the University of Copenhagen at age 23. 6 years later, he defended his doctoral thesis on widening perspectives of lead toxicity. And since, he has devoted his career to studying how environmental chemicals affect children and their brain development. His research has been supported by the U.S. National Institutes of Health, the European Commission, and the Danish Research Councils. He is the toxicology advisor to the Danish National Board of Health and has served in this function for over 30 years. Dr. Grandjean has published over 500 scientific papers and is author of Only One Chance, How Environmental Pollution Impairs Brain Development and How to Protect the Brains of the Next Generation, which was published by Oxford University Press in May of 2013. He also has a website, Chemical Brain Drain, which I recommend you check out at braindrain.dk. I'm sure he'll be giving you more information about that. And Dr. Grandjean lives in Copenhagen, Denmark, and in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and travels widely to study environmental problems and to examine children whose lives have been affected by pollution. Welcome, Dr. Grandjean. You may go ahead and begin.
Thanks very much, Diana. I'm very pleased to be with you and your colleagues today. I very much appreciate what you guys do because we can publish research papers by the hundreds, and they may not result in any changes in society unless somebody out there like you to help translate that research into action in society to make the environment safer and to prevent toxic exposures, especially to the next generation. So my reason for agreeing to speak with you today is that I feel very strongly about two things. Number one, I feel that I believe that the brain is a crucial organ for our lives, our livelihood, the quality of life, and for society. And we need to protect the development of brains because we need the best possible brain power in the future if for nothing else, and to make sure that the smartest solutions are found to clean up after us, because God knows we have made a lot of mistakes, and we need the best and smartest brains to find solutions for the future. The other issue is that I think that we know enough about this so that we can protect the brains better, and we're ready to initiate that action. And this is what I'm going to tell you about. So I have five central messages that I'll briefly mention here to begin with, so that you know what this is all going to be about. The first one is, of course, that the development of the human brain is exceedingly vulnerable to toxic chemicals. And we have totally misunderstood for decades what's going on, because we thought that when something like lead could damage brain development in children, it was because lead was particularly toxic to that particular part of our physiology. No. That is a misunderstanding. The reason that lead could cause all that damage is that the brain is exceedingly sensitive to toxic chemicals. So it's a property of brain development. And that means that there's a whole lot of other chemicals that can or may affect brain development in humans that may be just as bad as lead is. So that's the first issue I will raise. The next one is that the consequences of what I call chemical brain drain are very serious and have been underestimated. It's not just a matter of medical diagnosis like we looked at in the past. This is about the functioning of a brain, where we need every single bit of function become what our parents wanted us to be, and so that we express all of those talents that they wanted us to have and enjoy life to the fullest extent and contribute to society. So those consequences have been underestimated. The third issue is that the number of chemicals that cause these effects is increasing. We are finding new documentation every day almost, and I'm trying to keep track of this, and I'll show you some of the findings that we have made. The fourth issue is that the costs to society are a matter of billions of dollars every year. These are very, very sizable, and they have been totally ignored. Here comes the last issue, and that is we can act. We have the methods, we have the means, we have the insight, and we can do something about it. And so this is something I feel very strongly about, as you can understand. And so let me just walk you through these five conclusions and tell you a little bit about the background. And as Diana said, otherwise there's this book that actually, it took me 10 years to put together, so it's available. Anyway, it's easy to find on the internet. So I sent some slides, and you can download those. If you're looking at those slides, I'm now moving to the second one, and that illustrates the investment of society, which has to do with the brain development, the development of talents in children. We put a lot of societal resources into education. And if students flunk, we of course blame the students, but we also tend to blame the teachers, and we blame the schools or the universities even if performance is not as we expect. But there's something else to blame too, and I'll come back to that. You already know what it is, the chemical brain drainers. But our investment in education in society has been totally blind to these chemicals. In fact, some of them are actually present in schools, and school children, students, are being exposed, for example, to PCBs in the learning institutions, which I think is rather ironic. So let me move to slide three. We have made some very costly errors in the past. We have been very optimistic about how the first very serious error is that the placenta protects a fetus so well. We thought that it was an armor. That was what I was taught in medical school, albeit in Copenhagen. But my teachers were quite smart, I would say. I'm very happy about the education I got, except that the teachers knew very little about environmental chemicals. So we thought that the placenta would protect the fetus, and the fact of the matter is that it's more like a sieve. Environmental chemicals will pass the placenta, they will make it to the fetal circulation, they will make it to the fetal brain. So what the mother is exposed to, she will share with her child. The second error we made was in risk assessment, that we thought, oh, but of course children are much smaller, so the dose should just be taken into account in regard to the body weight. So obviously, exposure limit should be based on kilograms of body weight. So acceptable exposures would be lower for children, and that will be it. That's not good enough. An organism under development is much more vulnerable to toxic chemicals, not just as a matter of a lower body weight, but simply because all of those developmental processes are extremely vulnerable. We also thought that poisonings would be reversible, just like infectious diseases are reversible, but that is not true with effects that happen during brain development. If brain cells are not generated at the right time, if they don't end up in the right spots where they were meant to be, and if they don't send out the right projection so that they communicate with other brain cells and thereby establish crucial functions, then you don't get a second chance to do that. So these effects are not reversible. They are permanent. And as I say, you only get one chance to develop a brain. And you're stuck with that brain the rest of your life. And that's why it's so crucial to protect brain development. A fourth error that we have made is that, and I see it all the time. I work with expert committees, for example, under the European Commission, and my, excuse me for saying so, but my old-fashioned colleagues would say, but you know, we can't demand this kind of safety control unless we have proof that mercury or PCB or solvents, whatever they are, that they are really causing damage. And I'm saying, you know, how much proof do you want? Because if we really want a final proof, that's going to cost a lot of brains out there. And I think that, you know, if you believe in prevention, that's exactly what you want to prevent from happening. So the final error that we've made is that testing for these kinds of effects is simply too expensive, and therefore we can't do it. And so we better, you know, cross our fingers that the chemical exposures are safe and nothing will happen to developing brains. And that's just naive. Testing can be done. It's not too expensive, but there are certainly people in the private sector, people with vested interests of various kinds, who would say, oh, this is very costly to me. Well, you know, there will definitely be somebody who would have to foot the bill for developing safe alternatives. But if we don't want to do that, then the result is that somebody else will pay that price, namely the next generation, in regard to their brain development. Let me just go very quickly through the neuroscience on slide number four. why brain development is so sensitive. And first of all, it is an incredible feat that we are capable of developing the brain we have. Our brain is not the largest in the animal kingdom, but it is the most complicated, and it's one that fits in functions, very complicated functions, in the least space. If we had a brain organization like a gorilla, say, our brains would have to be much larger than they are. But the way that evolution has helped us, we are fortunate in having brains that are extremely efficient, given the space and the number of cells that are available for our brain functions. So at the peak of cell formation, every second we generate 200 new nerve cells. And those cells have to decide whether they want to become particular types of neurons or if they want to become support cells of various kinds, glia cells. And in fact, you know, the brain starts out as a little lump of cells that develop a little bit like a sausage. And you know, the brain is not something that sits in the middle of our body like a big sausage. It's actually a very complex structure where most of the cells are actually in the cortex. So, and in order to generate that structure, some of the cells have to migrate as much as a centimeter or two, which is an enormous distance for a tiny little cell. They have to find their own way and figure out how to get to where they were meant to be and meet up with some partners with which this particular cell will interact and help integrate the functions that we will need later on in life. And that is an incredible feat. Then they send out axons, those long extensions that have to go all the way down to the big toe and all the way out to our pinky finger. If you take all of those nerve threads and place them lengthwise, then in the end, you will be able to reach something like four times around the globe, all of the axons that you have in your body. So all of those connections represent a very, very sophisticated network. And then in addition to sending out those axons, each cell has about 1,000 or 2,000 contact points called synapses. And during the peak of development, then each second, the brain will develop 1,000 new contacts. So in fact, just after birth, there's a lot of contacts that are quite meaningless. And you know, infants will sort of move around in a haphazard way. And it's simply because the synapses, those connections, have not been fine-tuned. That happens over the next year or two, the child becomes capable of crawling and standing upright, etc. And so you also need to weed out those synapses that you don't need. So all of those processes here are very, very sensitive to environmental chemicals. So the neuroscience insight can be translated into a very important perspective in chemical toxicology. And as I said, if something here goes wrong, that's just too bad. You don't get a second chance to go back and sort of redo it. That there is some compensation capacity in the brain, but for that compensation to work, you got to have the cells available in the right places with the right connections. Then you can do some compensation if something else is not working properly. But it does rely on at least the majority of the brain functioning in accordance with the original design. Let me move to slide 5 to illustrate to you that brain development can go astray. And we first discovered that very dramatically in Japan in Minamata, the fishing village of Minamata, because there was a chemical company that released methyl mercury to the bay, and it accumulated in the fish. Nobody knew it. One couldn't taste it. The fish looked fine. But mothers who ate the fish, they would escape unscathed if they were lucky. But if they were pregnant, they would pass enough methyl mercury onto the fetus. And you see that terrible picture of a mother with her daughter who died a few years later. And the insight that was expressed by this Japanese physician was that, as he said, in every case, the mother was healthy, and it was not until more than 3 months after birth that the symptoms were recognized. So in the beginning, they thought the children were just a little slow, but then it turned out as the brain further matured, there wasn't enough brain substance for the child to develop normally. Now, all of this happened way before what we call the Barker, or some people call the Barker hypothesis, that our prenatal development is very important to our adult functioning and our disease risks as adults. But in environmental health, we actually knew that already in the 1950s, way before our colleagues from cardiology and internal medicine, before they realized it. And let me show you some of that very dramatic documentation on slide 6. It comes from the neuropathologists in Japan who looked at the brain structure in people who died from methyl mercury poisoning. And at the very top, you see a brain, an adult brain, and the little dots indicate the areas where there is damage to the brain substance that you can see in the microphone, in the microscope. And in the adult, you see that structure on the lower left, that's the cerebellum, and the far left, that's the visual cortex. And on the top, it's a motor cortex. And this is very much in agreement with adults having problems with coordination of their movements and also having a very narrow visual field. They actually have a field like they were looking in a theater glass. So those were the main symptoms that adults would have. Now, if a child got poisoned, you see more widespread damage. And if the damage happened prenatally, and that's a bottom brain structure, you see that the damage is all over. And we see clinically that those patients who got poisoned before they were born, they have all sorts of terrible symptoms and dysfunctions. And the irony is that they were exposed to methyl mercury doses that were much, much lower than the doses that caused much less damage in the adults. So to illustrate the scale of damage that can result from chemical brain drainers, I want to show you slide 7. Which I've taken from Jessica Ray's work. She looked at the school data from Massachusetts the 351 school districts here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And she then linked the Massachusetts standardized math test that's given to all students in the fourth grade. She looked at those results and compared them to the average blood lead concentration in the school kids from the very same municipality, from the same school district. And what I've illustrated on this slide is that you can see The blue dot says some association that children born in 1992 and therefore were they passed that test about 2002. You see there's some association that the kids with a lower lead exposure before they entered school, they also had a higher percentage of correct responses on the math test. And if you then look at the red dots, those are from kids born in 1999, and so these are the test results from about 2009, it's the same tendency. And if you add them together, you can see a very clear picture that the lead exposures that are prevalent in this state, just like all other states of this country, and actually prevalent all over the world, you can see that they are in fact associated with how well the kids do on, in this case, it's a standardized math test. And there's a lot of additional information, in particular from the United States, because there are mandatory blood lead testing in preschool years. And in some states, that information has become available to researchers so that they could see what the association was with the school performance records. There are also data to show that kids who get expelled from school because of their misbehavior, they also tend to have higher preschool lead exposures. In fact, when you try to figure out what contributes to all of this, then before lead was brought in as an explanatory factor, a lot of evidence suggested that ethnicity and poverty would contribute a lot. But once you add lead exposure to the list of explanatory variables, it turns out that lead explains a lot more than those other factors do. And the reason is, of course, that people who belong to minorities and who are poor, they tend to live in more contaminated neighborhoods. Anyway, you can see from this slide that lead exposure is certainly affecting our population today. Let me move on to slide 8. I've mentioned lead, I've mentioned methylmercury. And when Phil Landrigan and I wrote an article for The Lancet in 2006, we looked carefully at the evidence, and we believe that there were five environmental chemicals plus ethanol that could be called chemical brain drainers. The others are toluene, arsenic, and PCBs. But when we returned to that issue 6 years later, 8 years later, we added fluoride, manganese, another solvent, perchloroethylene, two pesticides, chlorpyrifos, which is one of the most common pesticides used in the world today, DDT, and the brominated flame retardants. So I've added a little asterisk to indicate that most of those substances are, in fact, also recognized as endocrine disruptors. Now, the way that we found out about these chemical brain drainers is illustrated on the next slide, number 9, the time sequence. Because in the beginning, we, in most cases, found out about neurotoxicity in adults, primarily because of occupational health data, but also clinical documentation, you know, from suicidal attempts or accidents or various chemical explosions, et cetera, et cetera. And so we realized in many of these cases that the substances could enter the brain and damage the brain cells simply from that kind of observational studies. Which is, of course, not very systematic, but it does illustrate that there could be a risk here. So with time, researchers began to look at birth cohorts and document the children's exposure from, let's say, blood samples from the pregnant mother or blood samples from the cord at the time of childbirth, and then relate that to children's neurodevelopment later on. And that evidence added to a concern that, hey, this is probably a much, much bigger problem than just a small population of workers in particular trades that may be exposed to this solvent or that pesticide. This is probably a much, much bigger problem with perhaps millions of people, that is children, being exposed before they're born because of environmental releases of these chemicals, so that they occur in as food contaminants, in our drinking water, or in air pollution. And as you can see, this, the vertical scale on the left indicates that with time, we realize that the number of people involved in this, what I call a pandemic, it's a global epidemic that affects populations around the world. That number is increasing steeply with time as we realize what is really going on. And the right-hand scale is an inverted scale because we realize that the damage is happening at much lower doses than those that caused the poisonings in the worker populations. So if you turn to the next slide, it's sort of a stylized iceberg. At the tip of that iceberg, those are the currently, it's 12. And if you add dioxin, it's 13. If you consider air pollution, one cause of brain drain, that's 14. So we have more than 10 known exposures that can cause developmental neurotoxicity in humans, and that's the tip of the iceberg. We also know that a lot of industrial chemicals can reach the brain and cause toxicity to the brain in adults, and that number is currently 214. So I think that every single one of them is a risk to brain development as well. Because if the substances can pass the placenta, and they can, pass the blood-brain barrier, and we know that from the poisoning events regarding adults, then they can also pass the blood-brain barrier, which is immature in the fetus. And if they're toxic to nerve cells, they are even more toxic to nerve cells under development. So in addition to those compounds, we have some experimental animal literature, the testing procedures that have been done around the world, and there are probably more than 1,000 chemicals that are toxic to rats, mice, rabbits, guinea pigs, etc. And we need to look at that literature as well. There is a big literature, and that has not been utilized at all. I understand that EPA is currently doing that, and I think that there is about 100 or at least 100 substances that are neurotoxic to brain development in two species, at least two species. So I would think that there's 100 or more chemicals that are already known about from the toxicology literature that we ought to regulate. Now, the question is, can we really afford that? Well, the Nobel Prize winner, Jim Heckman, who's an economist, he developed that figure that is my slide number 11. And according to his research, you get more dollars back from your investment if you invest it early in a child's life. So what he's saying is that programs that are targeted toward safeguarding and stimulating brain development in early life, even before the current preschool programs. He says you get an even greater return when you test those kids later. They will show a substantial benefit. And I've added in red ink my suggestion that if in addition to what he's saying, if we invest in protecting brains against chemical brain drainers, it may be the best investment ever that we could make in society. So turning to slide 12, I want to emphasize that the brain differs from all other organs. You can donate a kidney if you want, and with your remaining kidney, you can have a healthy and happy life, being even more happy that you've helped a relative who needed that kidney. But with the brain, we need the full integrity of the organ in order to have optimal brain functions. And so we can't just expend part of our brain capacity and believe that we will be healthy and happy afterwards. There's no way. In contrast, we need to protect brain development to secure that we have all those brain cells available in the right places and with the right connections, because otherwise we will suffer. And it's not just a matter of the Massachusetts math test. This is also in regard to a host of other types of brain functionings and also behavior. And it's more than just a matter of a medical diagnosis. We don't know the exact reasons why ADHD and autism and autism spectrum disorders, we don't know why they are increasing, but they clearly are. And I think that environmental chemicals are very likely contributors. So the bottom line of this is that the brain is crucial to our livelihoods, and the brain is really what's making us who we are. That's why we need to protect it. So what can we do about it? Well, that's slide 13. There's a couple of things that we can do right away. And I always stress that there is something that mothers and consumers can do. Unfortunately, we can't, as individuals, protect ourselves and the next generation as much as we would like to, simply because those chemicals are not labeled. They're not identified. They don't taste like anything. You can't see them. You have them in your body without knowing them. And so the choices that we can make are limited, but at least we can say we don't want furniture with flame retardants. We don't want our rugs treated with chemicals to prevent staining. We can buy organic food and we can avoid using solvents at home, or at least air out if solvents have to be used, and prevent pregnant women and children to come near those fumes. So there are things we can do. Something we can also do is to start testing chemicals for this kind of property. And there is an OECD test protocol available. It has recently been approved by the European Chemicals Agency, so that it is ready once the legislators in Europe decide that this test protocol should be used to identify new toxicants. It's ready. And there are colleagues in this country, primarily at Johns Hopkins, but also at European institutions, that are working on cell-based tests where they have stem cells, neuronal stem cells, and other types of cells in culture. And they have a battery of tests that they use to figure out if a chemical is safe to developing brains or not. So we have those means, and they are ready to be applied. So we need to update our chemicals legislation. I'm not going to say anything about the Toxic Substances Control Act because I think it is a serious disgrace to this great country that our chemicals legislation is so terribly outdated, and actually it's almost criminal the way that we allow society to expose pregnant women and the next generation's brains to chemicals that are not tested. And even if they're tested, they're not regulated to protect developing brains. So I would say we need to focus on protecting this crucial organ as a main priority of future chemical legislation. And the bottom line here is that this has to happen internationally. And what Phil Landrigan and I were proposing, and what we're trying to generate, is an international clearinghouse or documentation center that can inspire more research in this field, coordinate research, and evaluate the evidence, and inspire legislation so that we can protect the next generation better. So my final slide illustrates the problem. You can see it's very similar to slide number two that I showed you in the very beginning. You see that funnel with the education coming into the child's brain, and then there is this a drain of brain power that is leaving through that faucet on the right-hand side. I have this website where I try to digest and share information in this field, and my colleagues have helped me developing a Facebook page and even on Twitter. So I'm doing my best to share the new insights, what I find in the scientific literature, what we learn ourselves from our own studies and from what we read and what we observe. And if you want to contribute by, you know, you can upload comments, and you can use the hashtag chemical brain drain on Facebook if you want, or Twitter, then I would certainly welcome this, because we need more communication. We need to share this information, and we need to stimulate and inspire more research and more decision making, and also more enthusiasm about protecting what I think is the most crucial resource for society, namely the brains of the future. That was my introduction to the discussion, and I hope I have shared with you my own enthusiasm and also worries why we need to do something in this particular field, and I would very much welcome your comments and questions. So thank you, Diana, and thank you, everybody.
Thank you. Wonderful, Dr. Grandjean. Thank you so much. This is the portion of the call when we invite questions and comments from participants. We have about 10 minutes to do so. So if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, please press star 2 to unmute your line. Please also state your name and affiliation. It's good just to know who's calling, where the question is coming from. And we ask that you try to be brief, just so we can get to a number of questions before we're out of time. So thank you.
Good morning.
My name is
Jessica
Winstopper with Chicoloon Native Village. And thank you very much for this overview. I wish we had the opportunity to listen to you a lot more and learn a lot more. But thanks for this introduction. One question I have is on your slide 7 about the Massachusetts mass scores in relationship to the blood lead quantities at preschool age. Why was there such a dramatic difference between the 1992 born and 1999 born students in their lead quantities? What was the environmental factor that made the pink dots all on one side and the blue dots all on another side?
Okay, let me answer this very quickly. This is Jessica Rye's work, who's a social scientist, and what she did was to take the average blood lead measurements after excluding the highest value. She did that for all of the kids, and over time, lead exposures in North America have decreased. So what you see that the red dots are to the left of the blue dots, that's simply a result of blood lead concentrations decreasing over a seven-year period. This has been seen in many countries and also multiple states here in this country. And so the apparent effect of this is that at the same time, the percent correct answers have increased toward 90% or even above. And so this is like a side effect, if you want, of society being better at controlling lead paint, polluted soil, canned food that used to contain lead. All of those various sources are better controlled nowadays. I don't think that, I mean, you can see the exposure limit for that CDC has published. It's too high. It doesn't protect enough. And I think there are more gains to be made by even pushing lead exposures further down below 1 microgram per deciliter. So, and I think these numbers that Jessica Rice has collated, I think they clearly show that.
Thank you. Another question or comment?
This is Vaiwari. I'm a Native Village of Savunga tribal member. I'm a mother and grandmother. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank our presenter, Dr. Grandjean. This is a very important and very interesting take on. I'd like to thank you for all the information that you have provided us. I just have a comment. As a St. Lawrence Island Yupik mother and grandmother, my concern and comment is that our people here in the Arctic were on the receiving end of these global contaminants, persistent organic pollutants. Our traditional foods, our main foods, the bowhead whale, walrus, and seals, are so contaminated with global contaminants at levels we should not be eating them. And this will result in a culture. Our children will not be able to pass on our languages, our songs, our traditions, and our culture, and our people will die off. So this, not only for Indigenous people of the Arctic, but other Indigenous people worldwide that rely on traditional subsistence foods. Our cultures, our languages, our songs are at risk. We already have health disparities in our communities. So I'd like to urge the people on the call to step forward. There's a crisis here. We need support from not only in Alaska, but the whole planet as a whole to make changes so that our cultures and way of life and people can be saved.
Yeah, I know. I understand. I wholeheartedly agree with you. I've been to Alaska a couple of times, but I've only been peripherally involved in research there. But I do conduct studies in Greenland, and I think the circumstances are very similar in that there is an indigenous population who suddenly realizes that their traditional way of living, eating seal, for example, is something that can't be considered safe anymore. And when I tell them that the seal is full of perfluorinated compounds, they say, what? what are you talking about? And I said, well, these are toxic chemicals that actually, they don't really come from your own society, but those substances move with marine currents from faraway countries where they have produced millions of pounds of them every year and release them to the environment. And finally, they end up in the marine food chains, and that's what you're eating. I'm sorry, it's a fact of life. And all I can say is that we have to work together to try to create a safer world for everybody, and in particular for the next generation. And unfortunately, the first thing we have to do is to realize that we have a big problem in front of us. And the indigenous people in Alaska and Greenland and elsewhere, they are actually at the center of this particular problem. I find it a huge matter of injustice, and I'm desperate in regard to what I can do myself to correct this. But as I said, the first step is to realize that it's there, and then we have to work together to see what we can do to find solutions.
We have the ICC process coming up, and we have a chair for the U.S. Is there recommendations that we should be promoting this process as we go forward?
Your question was difficult for me to understand, so perhaps Dr. Granjan didn't hear it either.
Have a process that we can promote forward in the ICC process with the U.S. holding the chair?
I'm sorry, ITT? I'm sorry, what's that?
I think it was ICC. Was it ICC? Inuit Circumpolar Conference? Is that what's being spoken about?
Yes.
Okay. The ICC, Dr. Granjan, are you familiar with Inuit Circumpolar Conference?
Only peripherally. I work with the AMAP, the Arctic Monitoring and Assessment Program, and just very recently I reviewed a chapter that colleagues from several Arctic countries have put together on the health risks associated with chemical exposures in the Arctic. And I think that chapter is still being developed, but it should come out later this year. And I think it provides very, very strong evidence that what we perceive here in the temperate zone, that like Boston or Copenhagen, what we perceive as big problems, they are really, really huge in the Arctic. And so my contribution, I'm not so familiar with ICC, but my contribution, at least so far, has been mainly through AMAP, and I think it's a great organization that helps provide the scientific evidence for the Arctic Council.
I had a question, Hi. I had a question. I am enthusiastic about this and have been for a while. We work a lot with pesticides here on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and there's two of them that I see a lot used that are on the list online, and that's glyphosate and imiclopride. And I wondered what the extent is on the documentation of that being a brain drain. Thank you.
In regard to those two substances, we don't have enough evidence to say that they are definite brain drainers in humans. But I think both of them are on the list of substances that can cause neurotoxicity in adults. So that means that they can enter the brain and cause damage to brain cells. I think they're very likely also to be capable of causing damage to brain development in humans. So as I said before, I recommend pregnant women to stick to organic food if they can. And I'm much aware of the use of pesticides here in Massachusetts on Cape Cod and elsewhere. And I understand the argument from the farmers, but I would say they should also appreciate the needs to protect the brains of the next generation, and hopefully with time they can find safer solutions without using Roundup and substances like that.
Hello, I'm Tracy. I believe we have time for one more question, just one more probably. So go ahead, whoever started.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Just a quick question. As a physician, I'm trying to decide what to do about the recommendation for pregnant women and infants fed tap water and whether they should drink fluoridated tap water. Do you have any record or insight about this or thoughts about this?
Okay, it was a little hard to hear because I think you're talking from a cell phone, but you ask about fluoride in drinking water, correct?
Yes, for pregnant women and infants being fed through formula.
I think in regard to fluoridated drinking water, the jury is still out. But what I believe very strongly that we have seen, because I've studied this very intensely myself, is that elevated levels of fluoride in drinking water can cause brain drain in children. This has been shown very clearly in studies that have been done in China. And in China, it's for a study of this kind, it's a very important setting because those families, they stay in the same place. And therefore, we can, when we examine the kids at school age, we know exactly where they have gotten their water from since before they were born. And therefore, it's the studies that our Chinese colleagues have carried out are of very high quality. And so when we put all of this evidence together, I think there were 27 different studies that we looked at. We find that there is definitely an association. Kids exposed to higher levels of fluoride in drinking water, they have lower IQ levels. And so we presented this, and I've discussed this with the Centers for Disease Control, and I think we need to look at this very carefully because so many people in this country get fluoride from their drinking water. And while it does have some important effects on the teeth, what the water does is that you absorb it and then you circulate it in your whole body and it can enter your brain. It has nothing to do in the brain. And we need it on the teeth. That's where we need it. So it's really not what President Obama is talking about, precision medicine as a new goal. And fluoridated drinking water is as far as you can get from precision medicine. So I hope that the CDC is listening in and that they will initiate research in this field so that we can make sure how much fluoride can we really tolerate and how much can, in particular, developing brains tolerate so that we can protect the next generation better also against this substance.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Can I get in one more comment?
Oh, make it brief. Yes, you may.
Yes. This is Ali Hamadi from the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. We work on some topics related to traditional foods. And I just would like to make this comment that we should really not discount the benefits of traditional foods, fish and seal and marine mammals, because there have been many established good health effects resulting from eating those foods. And they're not just health effects. They're also traditional, religious, and cultural that are so important to the traditions that Ms. Swaggy was talking about. And while we do need to reduce contaminants as much as we can, there are many studies showing the abundant benefits of consuming some of these foods. And that's why the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium has this big initiative called Store Outside Your Door, encouraging consumption of these foods. I just wanted to insert this comment so people didn't walk away thinking that it was really bad to eat those foods.
I appreciate that. I wholeheartedly agree with you, and I can tell you that my colleagues in Greenland, they have the same perspective that you do. We have to look at both sides and not just the contaminants. But again, I still find it very unfair that a food that used to be entirely healthy, that's now being endangered the way that it is endangered due to our irresponsive use of toxic chemicals in the rest of the world.
I agree. Reduction of chemical concentrations in foods and other media should be really a top priority.
Thank you.
Can I get in one more? Just quick thing, Diana, this is Alexis Ross-Miller. I'm the new advocacy director for ACAT. I'm based here in Juneau in the state legislature.
Yes,
so
please.
My comment to anyone, the woman in Savunga and the woman from Chicoloon and anyone else who is an Alaskan, you should be contacting your state representatives, state legislators, writing letters, making phone calls, complaining about this issue, and more will be to come from me to people that are on this call regarding what's going to happen in the state legislature and the issues that we're working on for Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Great. Thank you, Alexis. And that does conclude our teleconference. We really are out of time, and I have to make a few closing remarks. I did want to give you, Dr. Grandjean, a chance to say anything if there was anything else that you wanted to add.
I've really enjoyed being part of this discussion. I think that the questions and comments were highly relevant, and I'm proud of being part of a group with you, with whom I share the same enthusiasm. So we should work together, like some of the last comments also suggested. We should work together because we have goals in common that are very, very important.
Absolutely, and thank you, because we are all working on a different aspect that needs the other input to tell the full story. So thanks to everyone. There will be an MP3 recording of this teleconference available on our website, and you will receive an announcement when that's ready. Our next call will be Wednesday, March 4th. The call will be on flame retardants and public health, fire safety without harm, with Dr. Arlene Bloom, and we've had her as a speaker before. She's really excellent, and so please sign up for that. You can register on our website. And if you have additional questions or comments, please feel free to contact us. The phone number is 907-222-7714. You can email me, diana@akaction.org. And thanks again to everyone for calling in. Have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Thank you for me, too.